Okay. So, first of all, let me remind you where we were. So, homework 3 can be returned. Homework 4 is due. Homework 5 is on the web. So, we studied finite type invariants. We realized, there is a theorem that we are proving, which says that the dual space of our finite type invariants are in some sense the dual of this space A. So from this point on, we want to spend a lot of time studying A. A is the space of core diagrams. It's graded by the number of core diagrams. Modulo the relation, the so-called 4T relation, which is, well, if you have four diagrams that differ only as follows, as shown, then the first minus the second is equal to the third minus the fourth. And then that was for the case of framed knots. For the case of unframed knots, the corresponding space is A modulo the framing independence relation, which says that if there is an isolated chord in a core diagram, you set it to zero. Last time, I apologized for forgetting to bring a table of dimensions, so I'm fixing it right now. So for m equals 0 to 12, here are the dimensions of am reduced, the degree m piece of am reduced. So this is the number of, well, not quite, but like 232 is the number of degree 12 invariants modulo degree 11 invariants. Okay, so the new invariants of degree 12. Okay, of unframed knots. Likewise, for framed knots, the corresponding number is 548. And you will notice that 232 plus 316 is 548. And I think the only question in homework assignment 5 is to figure out why this is so. Okay? Now, I should say that these numbers are somewhat inflated, because we will see today that, without a proof, we will see today that that this space A is really an algebra, and in fact, it is a polynomial algebra over a smaller set, the so-called set of its primitives. But this we will not show today. And so what really matters is the space of primitives, and the dimensions here are indicated on the lowest row, and the numbers above are really the numbers of possible products of primitives. But again, this should be clear later when we come to it. But just for completeness, I wanted to have the table on the board. Anyway, what I want to do today is... what I want to do today is to tell you about the so-called, or the what I'd like to call, the bracket rise theorem, which will do two things. First of all, it will connect to Wednesday, and not yet to Friday. So we will get a new space of diagrams which is closer to the one on Wednesdays. And second, it will connect to Lie algebras, but that will happen probably the next Monday. And hence the name bracket rise. This is sort of where the bracket first arises. Okay? So the theorem says the following. So first of all, let me rename temporarily this space A and call it A up C. So for the space A defined using core diagrams. Okay, so A up C is hereby defined to be just A. Okay, and later I will forget this renaming, okay? But temporarily I want to distinguish it from a new space which I claim is isomorphic to it, which I will call A up T for trivalent. And later I will forget the superscript in both cases and just case call everything A. So, you know, A will be a name for either using chords or using trivalent vertices. Okay? So later the superscripts will be forgotten, they're now just introduced temporarily. Okay? But I suppose I first have to tell you what A up T is. So A up T is the following space. It's the space of linear combinations of diagrams that look much like the diagrams on Wednesday. So they are trivalent graphs that have a circle skeleton, so they have a special circle marked on them. Within it, actually, the word within only refers to the way I draw it in the plane. The objects are combinatorial and abstract. I mean, it's not necessarily within, okay? But anyway, within it, there is a trivalent graph, but potentially just also chords, as in the A case. So, you know, here's a typical example. Now, the skeleton edges are oriented, so by convention, I will always draw it so that it's oriented counterclockwise, and I will never bother to mark the orientation. The internal edges are not necessarily oriented, however, the internal vertices are oriented. So what does it mean for a vertex to be oriented? So, in each internal vertex, there are three edges meeting. So, to be oriented means that one of the two possible cyclic orderings of these three edges is specified. Okay? So, either counterclockwise or clockwise. But the convention will be that when I draw things in the plane, let's add another vertex. So here on this vertex, I didn't specify the orientation. So the convention is that when I draw it in the plane, it's always counterclockwise. Okay? I guess I should add a few more things before I mod out by relations. So first of all, the degree of such a diagram is 1/2 the total number of vertices. So, in our case, there are, oh my god, too many. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12 vertices. So, the degree in our case is equal to 6. Okay, this is a diagram of degree 6. And the second point that I'd like to make is that I want my diagrams connected to the skeleton. Well, since the skeleton is itself connected, I suppose it just means connected in this case. But what connected to the skeleton means that from every point on the diagram there will be a path to the skeleton. I'm not allowing free components, you know, no extra graphs on the side. Okay? Okay, this is the total space. Now I have to mod out by relations. Okay? The relations are, well, actually there is only one relation, but it's more convenient to pretend that there are three. Okay? So, so The relation is the so-called STU relation, which says the following. If you have an internal vertex lying on top of the skeleton or connected to the skeleton, so the only way to tell that this is the skeleton from the picture is that it's rounded and has an arrow on it. Okay? Had it been, you know, if I were to be a bit more formal, I would have to use a different color. Or, you know, write a little S next to it or something. But this is sufficient. So the claim is that this is, sorry, not the claim, the relation I'm imposing is that this is set equal to this minus that. Okay? And this is a local picture, as always. So what I really mean is that whenever this appears within a big diagram, you can take the same diagram and replace it by either that or that, and then you'll have that the first is equal to the second minus the third. And these are called the S diagram, the T diagram, and the U diagram. And in a minute, I will tell you why. Okay? But even before that, sort of, this gives the theorem the name. Because somehow, the internal vertex should be interpreted as a symbol for the bracket. And in algebra, the bracket of two things is equal to their product one way minus their product the other way. So here, it's like the bracket of x and y. Of course, x and y don't mean anything in this picture. But the bracket of x and y is equal to their product. If you go along the skeleton, you read it this way, you see x times y. And if you read, if you go along the skeleton and here, and you read y and then x. So hence the name bracket y, rise. Okay? Anyway, the other two relations are in fact consequences of this one. So if you wish, a further piece, a further part of the bracket rise theorem, or if you wish, you know, theorem number two for today, is that this relation, well, not only makes A trivalent isomorphic to A up C, but it also implies two further relations. One is the anti-symmetry relation. So the anti-symmetry relation says that these internal trivalent vertices are anti-symmetric. So, what does anti-symmetric mean? It means that if you have an internal trivalent vertex oriented counterclockwise, and you replace it by the exact same thing oriented clockwise, then the sum of the two is equal to zero. So, in other words, if you flip the orientation, the sign changes. And the IHX relation, and the IHX relation says that if you have an internal I, so these are internal vertices, okay? No, nothing here is rounded, so it's inside the diagram, okay? Then you can replace it by an H minus, well, I'd like to write X, but you know, I mean, it has to be trivalent, so we have we add a little H here. Okay, so that's what X means. Now, I should have said that, you know, quadrivalent vertices don't count. They're just artifact of the projection. Okay? Now, I promise to tell you where the name STU came from. So, in quantum field theory, this is often called diagrams, Feynman diagrams like this are called S-channel scattering, this is called T-channel scattering, and this is called X-channel scattering. So originally I was calling this S, T, and U, and then it became clear that it completely doesn't make sense. Rather, you should call it I, H, and X, so S, T, and U moved to the other relation. Okay? Anyway, these are now the accepted names. Probably, practically everybody calls it this way. Okay. Some people call this one the Jacobi relation. And you see, if this is the bracket, this will become the Jacobi relation, but this will be later. Okay? Anyway, okay, is the statement of the theorem clear? Okay, so let's start proving it. So, okay, proof. Okay, there are two directions, right? I need to find a map from here to here and a map from here to here. Okay, so the first map, I don't know, what should I call it, phi, maybe, going from A, C to A, T, is obvious. Namely, a chord diagram is in particular a trivalent diagram, right? So if you have a chord diagram, then it's in particular a trivalent graph, so you can map it to itself. Okay? The only issue is to check that the 4T relation is satisfied, is mapped to zero, that the map is well defined, right? That if you mod out by 4T, it's still a well defined map. So we need to show that 4T is satisfied in A trivalent. But in A trivalent, the only relation we mod it out by is the STU relation. So in other words, we need to show that 4T follows from STU. In other words, that you can write 4T as a linear combination of STUs. So therefore, since in the target space you mod out by STUs, it means that 4T will go to zero in the target space. That's all you need to know. But this is obvious. No, sorry, not obvious. This is easy. Okay? So take a diagram that has a trivalent vertex in it, and perhaps many more things. So I'm only drawing the part of the diagram that I care about. And apply to it STU in two different ways. So I can view this diagram as a Y kind of hanging on top of this skeleton vertex. Or, yes?
Isn't it converse way that we should assume 4T and show that we have STU?
No, this would be for going this way. Again, I'm defining a map from AC to AT.
Right.
I've defined it on diagram.
Yes.
I need to show that the relations here gets mapped to zero over here. Otherwise, the map is not well defined. The way you define a map on a quotient space is you define it on the total and show that the relations go to zero.
So whenever we have two different diagrams in AC which are connected by this relation,
yeah,
we should show that image is
connected by STUs.
Right.
Or a different, again, saying two different diagrams are connected, it's a bit imprecise.
Yeah,
the more precise thing is to say that any 4T relation here gets mapped to zero over here. But to be zero here means to be a combination of STUs, which means to follow from STU. Okay? So anyway, consider this diagram in AT. There are two ways to apply, in fact, there are three ways to apply STU to it, but I'll use only two. Okay? So one is to use STU in this direction, and the other is to use in the STU in the second direction, in this direction. If you use STU on this direction, to this direction, oops, I didn't leave enough space, but, well, basically, STU says that you replace an internal y by two chords that do not intersect minus two chords that do intersect. So do not intersect will give you this, and do intersect will give you that, and that's the left-hand side of the STU relation. On the other side, you will get, again, replace the y, well, it's a y if you look this way. Okay? So you replace the y but by two chords that do not intersect minus two chords that do intersect, and that's the other side of the STU relation, of the 4T relation. So the map is well defined. Okay? Now I have to construct the inverse map. So the detailed, you know, the sort of, if you want to be absolutely precise, you need to be a bit more careful and do it by induction on the number of internal vertices. But rather than being absolutely precise and spelling out the induction completely, if you want, I mean, this induction appears, for example, I think in my paper on the Vasiliev knot invariants, which is on your which is one of the references in the about this class handout. Okay. But rather than being absolutely precise, I will give you the most of the proof. Okay? So, okay. So, let me show you that this map is onto. Okay? And in fact, I think this is all I need to show, because because why?
Why is it one-to-one?
What?
It's onto, but you need to show it's one-to-one.
Sorry, let me, okay, sorry, let me do it differently. Let me construct an inverse map. Okay? And so, construct phi inverse. So, to construct phi inverse, I need to do two things. First of all, I need to show you that everything here is in the image of phi, and secondly, that when I start from something here and write its inverse here, this writing is unique. The construction of this inverse is unique. And then that fully defines the inverse of phi, and then the map is an isomorphism. Okay? So first of all, why is phi surjective? Why is it onto? So, I think it's obvious. If you have a diagram with internal trivalent vertices, I don't know, say this one, I want to show you that modulo the relations that hold here, I can write it as something in the image. Something in the image would be something that has only chords. Okay? But if I want to write it as something that has only chords, well, I can use STU relations to reduce the number of internal vertices. STU says that whenever you have an internal vertex, you can get rid of it, or you can rewrite the thing with an internal vertex without an internal vertex. So this modulo STU is equal to, I suppose, this minus that. And now I can reduce again. Okay, I can choose one of those directions and reduce in that direction. Okay? And this can always be done, because we have started from a connected diagram. From connected diagrams. Because our diagrams always connect to the skeleton. So, well, if the diagram always connects to the skeleton, you choose one vertex which is near the skeleton and do what I just said. Okay? So, now I need to tell you that phi inverse is well defined. So implicitly I've constructed a phi inverse, right? I told you, given a big diagram, find the direction, reduce it in that direction. But I could have started and reduced it in a different direction. So instead of reducing it to this direction, I could have reduced it first to that direction. So I have to show that all different ways of reducing a diagram will give the same output. Okay? So there are a few easy cases, and surprisingly at the very end, there is one hard case. So, first of all, so I need to show that, you know, if I have a diagram, here is the inside of the diagram, and there are two edges that emanate from the outside and connect to the, sorry, from the inside and connect to the skeleton, I need to show that reducing along I is equal to reducing along J. I'm just making it sort of inventing symbolism. Modulo the relations that hold in the target space of I inverse, so modulo 40s. Okay? So now there are several cases to check. The easiest case is if I and J connect to different internal vertices. So, I mean, I didn't show where they connect to. If they just connect to different vertices, then the picture looks like the following. I could look at the interior as if it's like that. There is something coming out of it and it connects to I, and I connects to the skeleton, and then there is something else coming out of it and it connects to J, and J connects to the skeleton. Okay? But then, so the picture looks like this. But then, if I reduce modulo I, sorry, not I, modulo I, in the direction of I, I'll get the interior mess with like this here and that here. Minus the interior mess with the same thing crossed, and on the right, J. Okay? And if I, this is if I reduce in the I direction. If I reduce in the J direction, I will get so the I piece will stay, and on the right I will get either this or, this is not how the I piece looks like. So the I piece stays, and on the right now I get them crossed. Okay? But now comes the induction, which I didn't quite build up correctly. But the induction assumption will be that everything works properly for diagrams with a smaller number of internal vertices. These are diagrams with a smaller number of internal vertices. So I can reduce the remaining internal vertex whichever way I want. So I can reduce these whichever way I want. In particular, now I can reduce J on both of these diagrams. Likewise, I can reduce I on both of these diagrams. But then I simply get the same four diagrams here as here. In both cases, I get the result of reducing both I and J. And it's the same linear combination of four diagrams. This checks.
Is this the Diamond Lemma or something like that?
I'm actually using the Diamond Lemma without being explicit about it. Okay? I'm the diamond lemma is extremely lovely, but sort of, I'm not sure I want to introduce it right now. Okay? So this is somehow the big case. Okay? Then there are the next case is if I and J connect to the same internal vertex.
In this diagram, the edge coming from I could be the same as the one coming from J, right?
Yeah, it doesn't matter. I mean, if these two were in fact the same, it doesn't change the argument in any way. Okay? Right, I mean, I wrote it as a black box. The black box could have been a direct connection from here to here. Okay. The next case is... I and J connect to the same V, yet there is some V prime, there is some other vertex that connects to the vertex, to the skeleton. So yet, there exists some edge K which connects to some V prime, which is different from V. So the picture looks like this. I and J connect to the same internal vertex. So this is V, okay? But then I have a black box, but somewhere out of this black box there is a K that connects again to the skeleton and also to some internal vertex here. Or maybe I should make it look like this. Okay? What do you do now? Use the transitivity of the equality symbol. In other words, reduction in the direction of I is equal to reduction in the direction of K by the previous argument, but reduction in the direction of K is equal to reduction in the direction of J by the previous argument, so we're done. Okay? So, the next case is, no such K exists. So, I and J connect to V, and there is no other K. Now there are two possibilities. So yet no such K exists. So there are two possibilities. Option one, A, this is because there are no further internal vertices. So in this case, what can our diagram look like? Well, it can have only one vertex, I and J are connected to it. And the only the vertex must also connect to the skeleton somewhere. Okay? And, there may be further chords around. So that the picture is not entirely trivial, but there are no other vertices. So now, why is reducing modulo I equals to reducing modulo K, more modulo J? So reducing modulo I is equal to reducing modulo J because in the direction of I is equal to reducing in the direction of J because the difference between the two is precisely a 4T relation. That's the first place where we use the 4T relation. Okay? So by 4T and picture on the previous blackboard. So picture star. Okay? And then comes the only hard case, which is sort of extremely kind of strange. Okay? So other internal vertices exist, but they do not connect to the skeleton. So they can only connect to the skeleton via this vertex. Okay? So the picture looks like the following. You have an I here, a J here, something else comes to it, and then there is some blob over here. It's a beautiful picture, but it's the only messy one to show. Okay? So I claim mod 4t, I claim that reducing in the direction of I is equal to zero. I'm claiming more than reducing in the direction of I is equal to reducing in the direction of j. I'm claiming that reducing in the direction of I is equal to zero. And likewise, reducing in the direction of j is equal to zero. So therefore, reducing in the direction of I is equal to reducing in the direction of j. Okay? So, what is reducing in the direction of I? So, allow me sort of, oh, sorry, I should have added more stuff may be present. So there may be more stuff, but stuff that has no vertices. Okay? So what does reducing in the direction of I look like? Allow me to concentrate my attention on this part. The rest will not play any role. So if I concentrate my attention on this part, then reducing in the direction of I one way will give me a chord that goes in the direction of J. So right, I will get a chord going in the direction of J. J is outside of the picture now, I don't even care. And this whole blob will be pulled to the skeleton. Blob. Okay? Minus the same thing but crossed. So, the thing coming from far away will be connected on the other side of the same blob. Okay? Now, by induction, by the assumption that I can now reduce further, I can reduce the blob to the skeleton. In fact, not even by induction. I mean, I can just now reduce the blob by the skeleton by repeatedly using STUs. Okay? So this whole blob melts to the skeleton. Okay? And I have J connected either to the right of this puddle that's left of it. You know, it's actually quite clear. You know, it's not a blob, it's a snowman. Right? And now it melts to the skeleton, and J could be connected to the puddle, either to the left of the puddle or to the right of the puddle. Okay? Now, this puddle really stands for a big linear combination of things. But it's the same things here as here. Okay? So, I don't know, maybe I should call it P for puddle. Okay? So I claim that this is equal to zero always, modulo 4t. So I claim that this is equal to zero, modulo 4t, and this is an argument which is much more important. I mean, it will be used repeatedly later, so it is much more important than the tiny role that it plays in this theorem. Okay, so let me highlight it and call it theorem, and I'll call it the invariance principle, and it will be more clear later why I call it the invariance principle. And and later we will also somewhat generalize it, and I should say that in some sense it's the only thing I kind of really know about 40, about A, about the space A. Somehow everything that we will ever figure out about A will be either superficial, sort of happening on the outside of A, on the external parts of A, or will follow from the invariance principle. Practically nothing else. Practically this is the only thing we will ever need. Okay? But anyway, what does it say? It just says, well, exactly this. So if you have some core diagram, and you have an additional chord coming from far away, then connecting it to here or connecting it to here gives the same answer. So this is equal to that, and of course here I mean any chord diagram, not necessarily the one drawn. Okay? So proof of the invariance principle, and that also concludes the proof of bracket rise. So proof, so take the part D across which you want to commute J, okay? So take this part D. Well, I mean, I've chosen a specific one, but nothing that I do really matter. It doesn't really matter that I've chosen a specific one. And put, so I suppose it has three chords. So put 12 hooks on it, so where 12 is equal to 4 times the number of chords, as follows. No, not as follows, as above. So the four hooks will be one here, one here, sort of two near each end of each chord. So one here, 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 but that's 12. Okay? And put signs next to the hooks, so let me call this signed hooks. So let's alternate, plus, minus, plus, minus, plus, minus, plus, minus, plus, minus. And now consider the sum S of, or the sine sum, S of all ways of connecting J to the hooks. So J comes from somewhere far away, so consider the sum of all ways of connecting it to one of the hooks. And of course, with signs as indicated, okay? With signs as indicated. So there are two ways to study this sum. So first of all, S can be rewritten as, so consider all the internal edges, all the skeleton arcs of the diagram. So S can be rewritten as, first of all, sum over skeleton arcs of the two ways of connecting to each skeleton arc. plus the two exceptions. So there are two hooks that do not belong to an internal skeleton arc. Okay? So plus two exceptions. But you see, each skeleton arc has two hooks in it, on it, one with plus, one with minus, and connecting to this one or to that one is the same, because our diagrams, they're just combinatorial objects. Okay? So you get zero from the first term, and from the right term, you get, from the remaining term, you get this minus that, which is the difference we wanted to consider. On the other hand, I could write S as in the following way. So I could write it as a sum over chords of the four ways of connecting to the hooks around the chord. So I could write it as a sum over chords C of, for each chord, it's the sum of the four hooks around that chord of connecting. But you see, if you look at the four ways of connecting around each chord, it's exactly the 4T relation. So it's a sum of things that look like this minus that plus this minus that, and that's exactly the 4T relation. So this is a 4T, and we get zero. So we got that the right hand side is equal to, so we got theorem proven. Okay? Okay. I have two more minutes. So I'll use them to show you another consequence of this invariance principle. So claim A, which A? I'm no longer saying. So either AC or AT, I don't care. So AC of a circle is equal to A of a circle is equal to A of a line. Now what do I mean by that? So this should be clear. What I mean is take a circle and use it as a skeleton, if you wish. Okay? And what I mean by that was never introduced, but the meaning should be clear. Sorry, equal, I mean isomorphic. This should be the space of all chord diagrams whose skeleton, instead of being a line, instead of being a circle, is just a line. Okay? So the claim is that this is isomorphic to this, and by the way, the corresponding not-theoretic statement is that noting a circle is the same as noting a line. Right, so if you have a long knot, so-called, you can close it to get a circle, and you can show that if you have a circle or not, it doesn't matter where you open it. You get the same long knot, no matter what you do. Okay? So, what's the proof? So, the map from here to here is obvious. Namely, if you have a chord diagram with skeleton and circle, you just close the circle. Okay? The map from A of a circle to A of a line should also be obvious. You just take a chord diagram and you cut it open somewhere. Okay? So you have to show, so this is by cutting open. So you have to show that it doesn't matter where you cut open. So I have to show that cutting open at A or cutting open at B is the same. Right? But the difference between cutting open at A or cutting open at B, well, if you cut open at A, well, I'm running out of time. But the difference is if you cut open at A, then you have a cord coming from the inside and connecting, it ends up connecting on the very beginning of the diagram. And if you cut open at B, or maybe it's the other way around, you have a cord that starts in the same place but connects at the very end of the diagram. And apparently I lied to you, because this is not quite the same invariance principle, but it's the exact same proof. So you want to compare this with this, you put hooks all over in the same way, and there is now another exception when the two hooks are near the cord itself. But if the hook is here or here with opposite signs, I mean, in either case you will get a little picture like this, which is the same. So the two will cancel. So that's the end of the proof. Okay. So.